The House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1 p.m. on Friday, March 13th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Mina, Representative Vance, and Representative Eichheit, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my staff committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez. We have three items of business on today's agenda: HB 316, adjust damage limits, personal injury, wrongful death; HB 324, virtual kiosks. We are joined at 1:01 p.m. by Representative Jubilee Underwood. And HJR 23, constitutional amendment, governor's proposed budget. As our first item of business, we'll take up House Bill 316, adjust damages limit, personal injury, wrongful death, sponsored by myself. I would note for the record that the amendment deadline for House Bill 316 was Wednesday, March 11th at 11:59 p.m., and no amendments were received by the deadline. I will call my staff to come forward and just remind us what this bill does.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, Committee 8. House Bill 316 adds an inflation adjustment mechanism to the non-economic damages cap for personal injury and wrongful death. That is the damages for pain, suffering, loss of consortium, all the intangible things that people suffer when they are harmed by the wrongful act of another. The purpose of this bill is just to bring the non-economic damages cap in balance with inflation. As you may remember from our last hearing, we turned to the statement of intent of the original legislature that enacted this, which was to create a balance between the efficiency of the civil justice system and to discourage frivolous litigation without diminishing the right of innocent Alaskans to recover meaningful compensation. So the purpose of this bill is just to, by adding an inflation correction mechanism, restore that balance. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to speak to them.
Any questions or comments about House Bill 316? Representative Vance.
Okay, I broke what I said. I'm actually going to ask a question. This one's pretty quick, though, and it may have been addressed earlier, but you chose 100% of change in inflation. Why did you choose 100% versus the Alaska's typically impacted by higher cost? Is there a reason that you chose to stick with 100%?
Mr. Hitchcock-Lopez.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Vance. Thank you for the question. So that particular inflation adjustment mechanism was done in consultation with Ledge Legal. They did a review of the other inflation adjustment mechanisms in Alaska statute, and they recommended that one as being most consistent with our other statutory schemes.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments at this time? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. through the chair, Mr. Lopez, I see there was a letter of opposition from Insurance Trade Group. And the question I have is kind of related to insurance companies, which are opposed to this legislation, as I understand it. What do their CEOs make? You know, obviously that's a range. And then the follow-up question is, has CEO pay gone up since 1997?
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, thank you for the question. I'm not intimately aware of CEO pay. No one has ever made me a job offer that involved CEO compensation. I believe that it is significantly more than anyone in this building makes. And I also believe that it has increased significantly over the last 30 years based on my general knowledge of the news.
Representative Eichheit, do you know the answers?
I do. I was going to request a follow-up. I just have the four most highly compensated insurance CEOs. I won't name their names, but the CEO of Arch Capital Group, total compensation, $31.7 million annually. CEO of Chubb Limited was $30.1 million. CEO of the Allstate Corporation is $26.1 million. And CEO of American International Group was $24.6 million. So I'm sure all those individuals deserve their just compensation. I have no quibble with that. But those are fairly high figures. sir, I wish we could offer you that kind of pay. But I just, you know, the point is, I suspect those compensations have increased significantly since 1997. And I think Representative Gray, your bill is trying to make a just inflationary adjustments to those old numbers.
Thank you, Representative Eichscheid. Any other questions or comments from committee? I will just say that I thought really a really good point was made that the fees associated with bringing forth cases has gone up with inflation, and but these damages have not, and that was creating this kind of awkward imbalance where the risk of having to pay the fees, which have gone up, was outweighing the possible benefit of receiving the award. And I think that this bill does a good job of bringing that back into balance. So seeing no further questions or comments, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 316, Work Order 34-LS1463-I, be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 316, Work Order 34-LS14631-I as in India, is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. On the record, our second item of business is House Bill 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks, sponsored by Representative Alexi Moore. At this time, I would like to invite Representative Moore and her staff, Inti Mayo Harbison, to the witness table. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and make any comments about House Bill 324 to start us off.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Moore, District 28. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for having us again here today for House Bill 324. I'm just thankful that you guys are seeing this again and that we have opportunity for public testimony today with such a increase with these machines and fraud and how it's taking such an impact on our community right now, and especially our elders. I'm really thankful for the opportunity to be here again today.
Thank you, Representative Moore. Any questions or comments from committee before we take up public testimony? Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair to Representative Moore. Do you know roughly what the percentage of fraud that's been happening in these machines here in Alaska recently?
Oh, great question. Through the chair, we do. It is between 90 and 93% fraud on these machines is the activity that we've been made aware of.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just to clarify on that, so that means that 90 to 93% of the interactions with the machine are in some way involved with fraud?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Gray. That is correct.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? We will take up public testimony on House Bill 324. Public testimony on House Bill 324 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one, we will go online. I see Ethan McClelland, Assistant Director of Government Affairs at CoinFlip. If you would like to take yourself off of mute and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to be here, members of the committee. My name is Ethan McClelland. I am the Assistant Director of Government Affairs at CoinFlip, which is the largest operator of virtual currency kiosks in the industry by volume. Thank you all for the opportunity to speak on HB 324. Let me begin by saying that we at CoinFlip share the goal of HB 324, and that's to protect consumers from fraud. I think that the again, the goal of the bill is admirable, and the bill does a number of things that will combat fraud, but we think that the way that it goes about it is unfortunately a step too far. What would result from this bill is essentially a de facto ban on the industry. A little bit of background about the cryptocurrency kiosk industry. Right now, for people who want to participate in the crypto economy with cash, using a kiosk is the only way to purchase cryptocurrency. So what we found is our customers are folks who are operating in cash heavy industries, such as the service industry, truckers, service workers, plumbers, folks who have lots of cash who want to be able to invest in cryptocurrency and will value the convenience of being able to use a cryptocurrency kiosk. The industry or the business model works similar to what you would find at a currency exchange at an airport, where folks who want a convenient way to change cash to foreign currencies oftentimes will go to an exchange at an airport, where they will pay a markup on the currency that they're changing dollars to, say pesos or euros, and then the operator of that exchange, the markup is the revenue stream. It's a similar business model for our industry, where people who value the convenience of being able to go to their local store, do a transaction, change cash to digital currency, again, value the convenience of that. With regard to the numbers of fraud, first of all, I don't want to downplay the fact that there has been an uptick in fraud, and I'm happy to discuss more of that if anyone has any questions. However, I think we would dispute the numbers that has been reported. On our end, we've had reports, and our internal numbers suggest that the fraud rate is somewhere in the low single digits. However, that's not to downplay the fact that any fraud in any industry is a problem. And so we think there are a number of things that could be improved on in this bill. For instance, the most effective way to combat fraud is something that CoinFlip has been doing for a number of years, is to implement a hold for a customer's first-time transaction. So first-time customers represent the most vulnerable users, someone who's been sent there by a scammer, has not transacted at a cryptocurrency kiosk before, particularly senior citizens. And what we've been doing and have seen success at reducing the number of scams is to implement what's called a hold. That is where a customer does their first transaction. Before that transaction is allowed to clear new users, essentially a cooling off period of 72 hours, something like that. That allows the person to sort of separate oftentimes from scammers, that is indeed what they're interacting with, realize that they've been scammed before the transaction is clear and they're able to get a refund of their transaction. So I would encourage the committee to look at that in this bill, and I'm happy to share suggested language that we've seen in other states that has been effective there. With regards to some of the other provisions in the bill, first of all, I'll address the 3% fee cap that's in the bill right now. Operating a cryptocurrency kiosk is an extraordinarily expensive business. We have expenses that online exchanges don't have. We rent space from retail locations. We have to pay for the hardware, the physical machine, operating the physical machine, cash management, and that necessitates a higher markup fee. So we would encourage the committee to revise that fee. At 3%, we simply can't do business. It would be a revenue loss to stay in business at 3%. With regards to the transaction limits, we think that there is an important distinction that other states have made, and I'm happy to share some examples, where creating different, a tiered transaction limit for new customers, who again represent the most vulnerable customers, and then customers who are what we have called existing customers, and having a tiered transaction limit. So new customers, obviously, because of a risk management profile, you would want to see a lower transaction limit. We've found that $2,000 is a number that many states have settled on. The reason for that is it is tied to the federal suspicious activity report threshold at $2,000, where any money service business is required to file a report to the federal government around a suspicious transaction.
Mr. McClellan, please wrap up your testimony.
Yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir. So we just want to be a resource. We appreciate the committee trying to tackle this problem and want to work with you all on this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no further folks online or in person to testify, we will close public testimony on House Bill 324. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 324 for Wednesday, March 18th at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. Are there any last questions or comments for the sponsor about House Bill 324 before we set it aside? Seeing none, we will set House Bill 324 aside and bring it back up at a later date. Thank you, Representative Moore.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Our third item of business is HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget, sponsored by Representative Underwood. This resolution is up for its first hearing in our committee. At this time, I would like to invite Representative Underwood and her staff, Buddy Witt, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your introduction of this resolution.
Thank you, Chair Gray, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Jubilee Underwood. I represent District 27, downtown Wasilla. I am the sponsor of House Joint Resolution 23. I am joined today by my staff, Buddy Witt, who will be assisting with the presentation, and he will be available for questions. House Joint Resolution 23 proposes a constitutional amendment focused on the structure of Alaska's budget process. This resolution does not set spending levels. It does not eliminate any programs, and it does not raise any revenue. Instead, it addresses how the process begins. Under Article 9, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution, the governor is required to submit a budget and accompanying appropriation and revenue bills. Over time, statute has added structure and mechanics to that requirement. But the core constitutional obligation does remain broad. HJR 23 asks whether Alaska would benefit from strengthening certain structural elements of the budget process at the constitutional level, ensuring that the legislature begin its work from a clearly defined and disciplined framework. This resolution does not remove legislative authority. It does not eliminate the governor's constitutional role. It simply places before the voters a question of whether our fiscal framework should be clarified and strengthened. At its core, HJ 23 is about institutional design and long-term stability. It's not about a single administration or a single fiscal year. It's about improving the structure that will govern every budget going forward. Thank you, Chair Gray. We'll have a short slide presentation to walk through the current constitutional and statutory guidance governing the submission of a budget to the legislature to explain structurally what HJR 23 would do within that framework. So I will now turn it over to my staff, Buddy Witt.
Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Representative Underwood. And as the bill sponsor mentioned, this is a very brief, almost elementary overview of what you as legislators have as your guiding constitutional and statutory basic obligations and what the governor has as a constitutional and statutory obligation for submitting that that budget. Actually, it focuses more on the governor's responsibilities. I should correct myself. So, first, we have some constitutional requirements we just want to briefly go over. In Article 9, Section 12, the following requirements: submit a budget for the next fiscal year, include all proposed expenditures, include all anticipated income, include anticipated income. We'll talk a little bit more about the definition of anticipated income in a little bit. Submit a general appropriation bill, submit revenue bills for new or additional revenue, and submit at the time fixed by law. So those are all currently in Article 9, Section 12 of the Constitution. Talk a little bit about some statutory requirements. These are all found in AS 3707020. We all know that as the Alaska Budget Act. These are what are currently in the Alaska Budget Act as statutory requirements for the governor when he's submitting his initial annual budget. Budget released publicly by December 15th. We all know that. We see that. Transmitted to the legislature also on December 15th. And then any bills have to be delivered by before the fourth legislative day. Additional requirements. There is a requirement for bill separation in subsection A of Alaska Budget Act. Require separate bills for mental health, operating, and capital, and also revenue bills must also be treated separately. A balanced budget requirement is already in statute. We can talk a little bit about that if you want to, but we are focused more on the constitutional requirements. The Alaska Budget Act says that the proposed expenditures may not exceed the estimated revenue. Long-range planning requirements are also currently in the Alaska Budget Act. 6-year capital improvement programs as well as a 10-year fiscal plan projections. Format and supporting information requirements also in the Alaska Budget Act. Expenditures by agency, program objectives, prior year comparisons, and supporting financial data. We already know that. It's currently on the OMB website. You can go find that. And then there are some guidance on amendments and supplemental budgets. Again, this constitutional amendment does not touch any of these Alaska Budget Act requirements, but the governor may submit amendments after the initial submission, and he may also submit supplemental appropriations after his initial submission, which we are very familiar with. So what does HGR 23, what does it do, in fact? HGR 23 adds a new subsection to Article 9, Section 12, that we've already referenced in this slideshow. And the added provision requires that when the executive branch submits their budget each year on the December 15th of each year, the expenditures may not exceed the anticipated revenue, as is currently in statute. But the anticipated revenue does not include money in the budget reserve fund under Section 17. That is the constitutional budget reserve. So in other words, every year on December 15th, what this amendment, should it pass, is requiring is that when the executive, whoever that may be, submits their budget, the budget has to balance, and it has to balance without using the constitutional budget reserve. This would then, we hope, force the question of a fiscal plan, force some problem solving as to a long-term fiscal solution, and that's one of the reasons why the bill sponsor is doing it. In closing, the current system begins with numbers. The bill sponsor believes that the system should begin with a plan. HGR 23 asks the legislature to lead and the people to decide whether a stronger constitutional structure will improve fiscal discipline in our state. A yes vote moves Alaska forward to, we believe, predictability, accountability, and long-term planning. HGR 23 does not dictate what that fiscal policy will be. It strengthens, we believe, the framework within which that policies and those policy decisions are made. So with that, we hope that you will support the underlying bill. And Mr. Chair, I would say also for the committee that I had requested two individuals from Ledge Legal be available for question. I believe it's Ms. Wallace and Ms. Marks. Ms. Wallace will be available more for constitutionality questions, and Ms. Marks is the drafter, and she can talk about the drafting and also about if there anything comes up regarding amendments versus revisions. And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, yesterday in speaking with one of our members, Representative Vance, we spoke a little bit about effective dates. I want to point out one little item here. Currently, the way that the bill is written and the structure of the Constitution as currently written states that when an amendment passes, if the voters agree and decide to pass this amendment, then the effective date of that amendment is 30 days after the lieutenant governor has certified the election. The way our certification process works and the timelines are pretty big. That's another subject we talked a lot about. In the current framework of the bill, 30 days past a election certification would be, we believe, too tight of a window for the next executive. So we have offered a friendly amendment that would move the effective date to January 1, 2027, with the thought process being the new executive comes in and then they would have that first year to come up with what the legislature and the people of Alaska are asking for their executive to do, which is balance the budget without draining savings.
Thank you. Yes, we have Chief Counsel for Legislative Legal Services, Megan Wallace, online. We also have Marie Marks, who's the drafter. And we also have Rob Carpenter, Deputy Director of Legislative Finance, all available for any questions from committee members.
Thank you. I did, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carpenter's here to answer any fund transfers, any appropriations questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, this might be either for the bill sponsor or for Mr. Carpenter. What's the history of governors submitting unbalanced budgets? Has that happened a lot throughout the years?
Through the chair, to Representative Mina, for the record, Buddy Witt, we have included in our bill packet some research from legislative research. And we requested that they look back at the history of that particular question, and it goes back to roughly 2017, I believe, when the legislature passed the POMV model, and then it takes that history. Anything further back than that, I would have to get back to you on, but I'm happy to give you that research.
Follow-up? Through the chair, yes, I would love that research, and I'm really curious if there has been instances – since the history of the state where governors have submitted unbalanced budgets.
Unbalanced budgets?
Yes. Or what this resolution seeks to resolve, yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I believe I want Mr. Carpenter to answer. I will say, let me clarify. The research looks back and looks at the budget while using the CBR. So the CBR – a governor isn't allowed to pass a balanced budget or submit a balanced budget, yeah. An unbalanced budget. So they've just always used the CBR. So we're trying to break out of that practice.
For sure. Thank you for the clarification.
So to be clear, jumping off of Representative Mina's question, in some ways what this constitutional amendment is doing is saying that the governor must balance the budget without including the CBR.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is for Mr. Carpenter. And I just like for committee to kind of understand some of the history with accounts. We also have an SBR, a state budget reserve, that previously had a considerable amount of money in it. Mr. Carpenter, can you give us the balance of that and kind of the history? And the reason that we have seen over the past decade a consistent draw from the CBR, because I know that the legislature historically utilized the SBR, and I think there's we need a little walk through history to kind of get the bigger picture that that we're not without a savings account if we restrict the use of the CBR. From the governor in the balancing the budget. So could you kind of give us a bigger picture of that?
Mr. Carpenter.
Can you hear me? It's Rob Carpenter, Ledge Finance.
We can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the question, I'm going to, this is all off my memory. I've been here quite a while, but as you may recall, in the early 2000s, actually, in the 90s and the 2000s, we were running significant deficits. And but around the 2008 to 2010 area of time, when oil prices spiked and we had a major tax revision in the tax code, the oil tax code, we started earning a lot more money, and we paid back owed balances to the CBR, and we also put additional money in the SBR. So that's when we started. We had significant surpluses. We saved that money, a good portion of it, paying back the CBR, what we owed it, and then putting additional money, as you mentioned, into the SBR. That was the peak of the glory days, you could say. And so, since then, we've been, with prices coming down, have been drawing on our reserves. Most notably, the SBR was utilized first, given that it could be accessed with a simple majority vote. And then subsequent to that, we've been pulling from the SBR, the CBR, since then till we've come from around $12 billion, I believe, to where we are right now is about $3 billion in the CBR. Does that answer your question?
Follow up? Yes, thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Is there a current balance in the SBR?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, there is not. It has been fully utilized.
Continue follow up. Thank you for that. If this constitutional amendment were to pass, do you think it would create an incentive for the legislature to replenish the SBR to utilize for lean time so that the governor could be incentivized to make a balanced budget, but also make the necessary changes within our fiscal system?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I'm not sure I fully understand your question. If there's an incentive to replenish the SBR as a result of this, I see this more as a guide for the executive, the governor, to his required ability to balance his budget. His proposed budget will have to use a methodology beyond the CBR. So assuming he would, I would assume, propose revenue measures or make budget cuts or whatever is necessary for him or her to submit their budget according to the Constitution. What the legislature does with it beyond that is obviously at your discretion. You did kind of make me wonder, though, if does it exclude him or her from using the SBR? I don't know how to answer that. That would be an interesting twist, but I would assume that if the main point of the bill is basically to not allow the use of budget reserves or not to incentivize the use of budget reserves, that would be an interesting question for legal, possibly.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Is the SBR invested differently than the CBR?
Mr. Carpenter.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't know how to, I wouldn't say drastically. It might, I think the CBR has an additional component when the balance is significant to be more aggressive with the investments. Otherwise, I think the SBR is very conservative.
Thank you. And the reason that I was asking this, Mr. Chairman, is I've been here long enough when there was a balance in the SBR, and it was like, hey, you know, that's money available that's not taking away from, you know, like the higher education fund or something. And know that we've had governors face with some really tough times. But we want them to make the hard decisions. But just want to understand, you know, our path forward, because clearly this legislation is going to say, hey, we've run out of options. We have to make changes. And I think that's going to be accomplished here, because we've turned over the coffee cans, and we have to, obviously statutory guidance isn't enough, but this would give the strongest legal requirement to force the necessary changes. So thank you for offering more insight, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you. Follow up from Rep. Francis's line of questioning to the sponsor or to Ledge Legal, but does the governor would need to submit a balanced budget, not including the balance of the CBR, or if there were a balance in the SBR, the SBR as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I believe that is incorrect. The amendment before the committee bifurcate the SBR from being revenue that the governor can use. And if I would ask that perhaps that question be directed to Ms. Marks or to Ms. Wallace.
Ms. Marks or Ms. Wallace, does this resolution allow the governor to balance the budget using the SBR?
For the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. And to the chair, Mr. Witt is correct. It does not exclude the SBR, the statutory budget reserve. It just explicitly excludes the constitutional budget reserve. if it's the will of the committee to exclude specific items, then I recommend that either the constitutional provision be revised to explicitly exclude them, or you could say as provided by law and set out in law what specific funds you want excluded that are in addition to the constitutional budget reserve. But as written, the fund that is excluded is just the constitutional budget reserve fund.
Thank you. I guess then question to the sponsor. In the hypothetical that Representative Vance brought forward of the legislature coming upon a few billion dollars and putting it in the SBR, would it be the intent that it would be okay for the governor to balance, to submit a balanced budget in which she or he would just be like, oh, we'll take $2 billion out of your SBR, and then it's a balanced budget.
To the chair, Representative Underwood, for the record, this is just supposed to be simply all around the CBR, just keeping it straight and simple, not trying to constrain the next governor to find other avenues that are difficult or whatnot. Just this is going to the people to see if we want to just start the process with a little more constraint. That is the intent of this, not to limit every single access that the next executive would have, but just simply we need to grow our savings account. So keeping it to the CBR is the intent.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes.
And I would just add to dovetail off of what Representative Vance's line of questioning was as far as being motivated at what this would do as far as I could see this motivating the next executive to start stacking into the SBR just in case something happened in the future. Then there is a savings account that the executive can access in the development of their budgets. That would just my two cents.
One more question for me. What would be the consequences if this amendment passed by a vote of the people? If a governor submitted a budget that exceeded the anticipated revenue in violation of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would ask that question be directed to Ledge Legal.
Mm-hmm. So, Ms. Marks or Ms. Wallace, what would be the consequences if the governor submitted a budget that exceeded the anticipated revenue in violation of this amendment if it were to pass?
For the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. To the chair, I'm going to let Ms. Wallace answer that question. She's general counsel, is more familiar with potential remedies if there's a dispute between essentially the executive branch and the legislative branch.
For the record, this is Megan Wallace, Chief Counsel, Legal Services. The provision that's in front of you does not specify any particular consequence if the governor does not comply with the provision, but that there also is no specific remedy, so to speak, outlined if the governor were to fail altogether to submit a budget to the legislature for consideration. I suspect if the legislature really wanted to, it could potentially, you know, seek court intervention and get an injunction requiring the governor to amend his proposed budget to comply with the Constitution, and potentially that risk will serve as enough risk or deterrent to hopefully that the governor will comply. But I suspect that if this provision is enacted, the governor has an obligation to follow the Constitution, and so it may be, you know, there may be differences of opinion in terms of interpretation of what is revenue and what is balance, and there may be those nitty-gritty disputes. We can't predict what, you know, future legislatures and governors might disagree about. But other than court action or injunction or other legal action, there's no specific constitutional consequence.
Thank you. I have one more question. And going back to the brief history lesson we heard from Mr. Carpenter, I believe around 2010, the CBR had $18 billion in it at its height. $18 billion, when invested, can earn a lot of interest. Does this constitutional amendment forbid the governor from using that CBR interest in their balanced budget? Interest earned, I should say.
To the chair, I believe the interest earned on a balance remains in the same account. So my, I would have to get back to you unless someone who is available for questions could have that. But my, my assumption would be that just like every account, interest bearing account that we have, that stays in and builds with the principal.
Thank you.
Which doesn't change the definition.
If I were to refer that question, just for clarification, would you refer it to Mr. Carpenter?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would.
Mr. Carpenter, if the CBR were earning substantial interest, is that interest the property of the CBR?
Mr. Chairman, Rob Carpenter, Lynch Finance. To your question, I would say that reading the bill here, anticipated revenue does not include money in the budget reserve fund. So that would include any interest earned, would be my reading. And while I'm here, thinking back to the question of the SBR, I read this as expenditures for the next fiscal year cannot exceed anticipated revenue. So to me, that's pretty clear that budget reserves, fund balances, et cetera, would be excluded from an option to balance the budget of any flavor you want out there, like the higher education fund, the PCE fund. Those would all be off limits is the way I read this.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Ms. Marks, would you agree with that interpretation?
For the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. To the chair, I think that the governor will interpret it, the provision, as allowing him to use any money that is not explicitly excluded. And so, and I believe the governor now has been using, for example, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So my recommendation to the committee would be to make it explicitly clear what is excluded, that the committee either add that to the bill if they're concerned or put it in statute. I think the governor likely would interpret this in a way that would allow use of any of the funds that are available.
Thank you. So to the sponsor, it looks like on page 1, line 11, when it says does not include money in the budget reserve, we should either say constitutional budget reserve or any budget reserve fund. Maybe any budget reserve fund would be more clear to include state and constitutional. I see Mr. Witt's consternation, but I'm just wondering if we could be more explicit that we mean both budget reserve fund counts in this case.
Thank you to the chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, can you direct that question to Ms. Marks? Because I believe the rest of that sentence says the budget reserve fund established under Section 17 takes care of that.
Okay. So sorry, Ms. Marks, I didn't read far enough. Is the budget reserve established in Section 17 the constitutional budget reserve? Ms. Marks.
For the record, Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. To the chair, correct. The budget reserve fund that is excluded explicitly is described as the one established under Section 17 of the Alaska Constitution.
Thank you. Ms. Marks, is there an easy fix if we wanted to make sure that the state budget reserve was included? Or I'm sorry, maybe they don't want to do that. Mr. Witt. Oh, okay. Go ahead, Ms. Marks.
Again, for the record, Marie Marks, Legislative Legal Services. Yes, to the chair, there's a couple different ways you could do that. You could put it into the constitutional amendment itself. If you Alternatively, if you would like the legislature to have flexibility on what funds will be excluded, you could also provide that additional funds as provided in law. And then you could have a statute that is flexible and changes over time. There may be other funds. It may be called something different rather than a budget reserve fund, and that allows the legislature to have flexibility to add or subtract those via statute rather than have it static in the Alaska Constitution, if that is the will of the committee.
Thank you so much. Any other questions or comments at this time before we open up for public testimony? Seeing no other questions at this moment, public testimony on HJR 23 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one, we will go online. Let's see. Oh. Mr. Mike Coons of Wasilla, if you'll take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself. As a voter, in reading this, I would be a very cynical voter on this. Because, I mean, I like the concept. I like the fact that the governor would be submitting a balanced budget that does not exceed future revenue that's anticipated for that fiscal year. I'm all for that. The problem is we have a legislature that doesn't give a hoot and a holler about that. The legislature, so the governor, I see is right now, the governor could submit a bill, a budget based on these rules that is far less than what was then spent the year, let's say the year before when this wasn't in there. And all of a sudden, the legislature goes, oh, but we need this money for an increased BSA. Oh, we need this money for this. Oh, we need this money for that. And you just completely blow it out of the water. And then you turn around and you go, oh, well, we're exceeding our revenues, so we're going to vote to use the CBR or the if we had any money in the SBR, or if we had any money in these other ones that you guys want to keep on putting your fingers into and taking out of. So from a cynical voter standpoint, I don't know if I would vote for this just because of the fact that, well, yeah, it's in the Constitution. The governor has to do it, but there's no sidebars. There's no criteria that the state legislature actually stay within a balanced budget and not turn around and spend the money willy-nilly and using the CBR. The other aspect it says in here on line 10, the permanent fund available for appropriation is authorized by law. To law, the original PFD law or the POMB law? Which one are you guys going to use? Are you going to continue stealing the PFD under this POMB silliness that we have now? Or are we going to go back to the original where it was like, you know, we got it because based on 5 years and divided by the population, boom, it wasn't an appropriation. Even though the Supreme Court has said it's an appropriation, which is highly suspect in my mind and a lot of us. So I applaud the sponsor on putting this forward, but I think if this does get passed so that we the voter can vote on this, then we the voter needs to understand from the state legislature what this actually means, and if will the legislature actually do what they're supposed to do, and that's maintaining a balanced budget and not using the CBR, not using the SBR, not using all these other things, because the trust factor in this state legislature as it stands today is about as close to zero as you can get. And so that's my view on this, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no one else online to testify, public testimony on HJR 23 is now closed. I would now like to set an amendment deadline for HJR 23 for Wednesday, March 18th at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I just wanted to point out that when the governor submits his budget and then the legislature does what we're allowed to do, at the end of that, if the governor doesn't like the amount of spending that the legislature does, he still holds the power of the veto pen. So I just wanted to point that out in reference to Mr. Kuhn's comments that the governor will still hold his veto pen, and if we still have to have our two-thirds vote. So
that is true. Good point, Representative Underwood. Any other final comments or questions about HJR 23 before we put it aside? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. This might be for Mr. Witt. Could you talk again about the evolving effective date language?
Thank you for the question, Representative Mina. Through the chair, Buddy Witt for the record. Yes, thank you. So currently, effective dates of adopted constitutional amendments are 30 days post Lieutenant Governor certifying the election. And so when you look at how our election system works, and we have in our system a pretty lengthy amount of time as we wait for ballots from Interior Alaska, that could just – it's hard to know what that date is going to be, what we're going to end up with. And so it was the bill sponsors request to me to get a blank sponsor amendment that changes that effective date to January 1st of 2027, with the concept being whoever the new executive is would then have from swearing in until budget submittal to put in the work and get some kind of a plan.
Just a follow-up. Through the chair, I'm just thinking about the timeline when the governors do create their budget. And from my recollection, it's around summertime where the departments report out their spending to the governor, and then they spend fall crafting those budgets together. And I'm just trying to think logistically, like if this were to pass, I feel like it would make sense to have more leeway in time for when the governor starts to develop the upcoming fiscal year budget in that summertime, rather than if this were to be affected in January. I mean, the governor is supposed to already
Through the chair. So, Representative Mina, the effective date would be January. If our amendment, friendly amendment, were to be adopted and the bill were to get through the process, the effective date would be January 1st of 2027, which means the real effective date for when actionable would be December 15th of 2027.
Perfect. I get it now. Fiscal year 28 budget. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just to put a finer point on it, because we'll have a new governor, and I think that does matter. Thank you. I would now like we set the amendment deadline March 18th, 11:59 p.m. We will now set HJR 23 aside and take it up again next week. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here is a preview of next week's meetings. On Monday, March 16th, House Bill 298, Legislative Ethics Committee and Proceedings by Representative Galvin. HB 250, Law Enforcement Concealing One's Face by Representative Hannon. HB 74, The Crime of Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbags will be back up in our committee by Representative Tomaszewski. On Wednesday, March 18th, HJR 43, Voter Privacy, that's our committee, the Judiciary Committee. HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment Corporation and Rights by Representative Fields. And HJR 41, Rescind Requests for Constitutional Conventions by Representative Schrage. On Friday, March 20th, we will have HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment Governor's Proposed Budget again by Representative Underwood. And HB 367, Consumer Data Privacy Act by Representative Story. The time is now 1:56 p.m. and this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.